Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Betsy and I have a special episode for you on the topic of divorce. As bleak as it sounds, the beginning part of the year is the most active time for divorces. Our guest, Margaret Clore, will talk about how breakups don't have to have messy endings, but rather new beginnings. Clore is a top family law attorney who will talk about her new book, Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche, and other true accounts from the files of a family lawyer. You will not believe some of the things Clore has encountered during her career. From heated prenups to sperm donors, from ugly mudslinging to post-divorce peace, she has seen it all.
These provocative true cases explore the intersection of our most intimate relationships and the law, and offer a window into how we define a family today. In this emotionally rich and intellectually compelling book, Margaret reveals how the law reflects our most telling and fascinating cultural trends.
We are pleased to have on our show, Margaret. Thank you so much, not only for coming on the show, but for the very incredibly informative and necessary book which you wrote.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The
first question that I want to ask, and is my observation, we are simply naive as a people, and we tend to believe that the law is something that is equally applied to everyone. How much does a judge actually have the ability to bend and twist and create whatever he wants to in his own eyes or our own eyes?
Well, I think that's a complicated question because the law can be applied equally, let's say in the context of a child custody case, but the law in child custody provides for a lot of subjectivity in its application. So it can be followed, but it assumes that the judge is going to be making determinations about what's in the best interest of a child, for instance, which are by definition informed by the judge's own experience. So it's hard to say that the judge isn't following the law by pulling on their own life experiences to make decisions. They are, in fact, following the law, but there's a line that we don't want a judge to cross. Like, we want them to have wisdom. We want them to understand the world out there. You know, that's why judges are usually older. It's not usually a job that you get appointed for when you're, in your 30s. Like, we expect judges to have this sort of basis in the world, but we don't want them to go too far and just be looking at their own life experience and saying, well, I didn't do it this way, so therefore this isn't a good way to raise a child. I think that's a complicated question.
I think you gave a great answer. I do think that we should realize there are some people who grow old and some people who grow up. And age is not necessarily an indicator of either one.
Yes, I think that's true.
So let me ask you this question. What are the reasons that people generally get divorced? And do you think that we are now in a culture where we have simply no patience and tolerance to work through problems that the last couple of generations actually worked through? Or are we smarter in realizing when something doesn't work, let's just try something new?
Well, I would take issue with the question because the divorce rate is dropping. It's been dropping since the 1970s. It hit a high in the 70s and the early 80s, and it's been coming down ever since. So it's not the case that more people are getting divorced now than used to. It depends how far back you go, but it's on the downhill slope, and I think that the huge spike in the divorce rate, which happened in the 70s, has to do with the advent of no-fault divorce laws. I mean, that was when divorce codes all over the country, because every state has its own law about divorce, were changing, and the modern divorce code, which was to get rid of the requirement that you had to prove that the other person had done something bad to you in a court in order to get divorced, those laws all changed, and they kind of fell down like a house of cards. And now there's no state in the country which requires that anymore. And I think that, you know, created a huge sort of, there was like pent-up demand, you know. There was a huge spike in divorces. But actually, that's, you know, the rates have declined since then. And so that's one thing. But the reason, you're asking about what I think the reasons that people get divorced are, and, you know, it's interesting being a divorce lawyer, because I think some people assume that I know why everybody's getting divorced. And I don't, I mean, I know what the clients want to tell me, because to me, it's not necessarily that important why they're getting divorced. And if they would rather not talk about it with me, because I really, once they get to me, they're not talking about should they stay married or get divorced. They're getting divorced. So
interesting question, Margaret. Do you ever tell a person after they tell you their story, maybe you really haven't tried to go to counsel and maybe there's enough substance in this relationship to give it a shot? Or when they come to you, do you simply say, okay, that's not my job. They came to get divorced. I'm going to go through the process.
I certainly have asked people as a way to just make sure they're really making a mature decision in my mind, like, have you been to counseling? But I got to tell you, like, I don't really see a lot of people that I think are like taking this lightly. I mean, people usually, by the time I see them, either if they're the one that wants to get divorced, they've been thinking about it for a really long time, and that's what they'll say, and they'll say the marriage has been, you know, essentially over for a long time or whatever. You know, it's not, or we've been in counseling, they'll tell me that, you know, for 2 years, and, or sometimes they're the person who doesn't want to get divorced, but their spouse has announced, you know, that's it, it's over, and then it's not, you know, there's not really anything, they're not in control of that process. And then there's the third option is that there's, you know, it seems like it's mutual and they've just drifted apart or whatever. But I would say I stay away from really, you know, it's outside my pay grade. Like, I'm not a therapist, and I feel like if they're coming to see me, it's because they want advice about getting divorced. And sometimes they just want advice. You know, it might be somebody that's thinking about it, and it's just like a consultation, and then that could or could not turn into a case that I'm actually representing them in down the road. They might come to me to talk about it, and then I never hear from them again, or they come back in 5 years because now actually it's happening, you know. So, yeah, I don't get into that too much with people.
Can I ask you a question? Because you say that one of the reasons that you got into law was through feminism and your concern with domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And there's this awful lineup in your book of bad guys. Your story of Brian and Beth being one of them. And I wonder, in those cases, do you intervene? I mean, we have a real epidemic. We may have a decline in divorce, but there's a New Yorker article last year about this epidemic of domestic abuse. I think 3 women and 1 man are killed every day by a spouse. In those cases, don't you intervene and say to a woman who is battered and really almost non-compos because of the abuse, you got to get rid of this guy? I mean, like the fellow who burned up the wedding dress in the backyard. I mean, these guys were, as you call them, absolute jerks.
Well, yeah, but usually in that, the context is I'm already representing them in either, you know, getting a protection order or a custody case, and they're not together. By definition, if there's a custody case, they're not together with the abusive partner or spouse or a divorce. Like, so in terms of intervention, I would say more what I do in those cases is I try to help my clients who are survivors of domestic violence feel stronger. Like, I try to make them feel that they have power to make decisions, because a lot of those clients are really, like in the context of a divorce case, let's say, they're really their thinking has been really affected by having a spouse who tells them, who is so controlling, that like they'll say to me, well, he says I won't get anything in the divorce. And then I say, you know what? He won't control that. Actually, there's laws that control that, and I'm going to represent you, and here's the range of what could happen, and we can make this happen for you. It's not, he doesn't get to decide that you don't get part of his pension. Like, I try to make sure they understand that they actually have some power, and I certainly do. You know, if I'm representing a woman that is, if the presenting issue is the domestic violence and she's currently in danger, I try to do a lot of work to help with safety planning and all that. But I'm not usually seeing people before they're separated and there's domestic violence. I'm not, you know, someone's not coming to me with an intact marriage that's abusive the way, like, you might have a friend that's in that situation and it's really difficult because, you know, they come to you, but they're not, you know, it's hard to know how to support them. But yeah, it is a big part of any family lawyer's practice. It's such a, you know, it is an epidemic, and it's also a common reason that relationships end. So if you're dealing with divorce or custody, there often is an element of domestic violence, and it's also it's the cases that are not easy to resolve because you don't have a parity of power. Like, you can't really negotiate with someone who has been beating you up. You don't have the ability to. You need a lawyer to help you. You can't just go home and sit down with them in the dining room and figure out how you're going to divide up your stuff because you're afraid of that person. So
plus you don't have witnesses, right? I mean, in the case of a domestic violence, there's normally not a witness unless they're children.
Yeah, well, that's true, but sure.
I'm born and bred in New York City, Margaret, and in New York, in Manhattan in particular, the divorce rate is definitely higher. But what I found to be interesting is that the hatred is almost as great for the lawyers as many in New York go through more than one or two or three than it is for their own spouses. Now, reading your book, even hearing you know, here's a intensely ethical person who's looking to do the right thing. But you, from my perspective, are the exception to the rule. You know, all the lawyers' jokes don't come from nowhere. What do you do? What do you do when you find that you have an adversary as a lawyer who's simply looking to draw this out and just bill and bill and bill and dilute the family assets, and has no real reason, no desire to represent his client or to come to a fair and a quick resolution? How do you handle it?
Well, let me say that there are lawyers like that. I've been practicing a long time, and I'm practicing in New York before I moved to Philly. And what I will say is that that's a very, very small minority. It is just, and one of the reasons that motivated me to write the book was sort of to talk about like the inside story of like what it's like to practice family law, because this is not unique to me. Most of my colleagues want to help their clients, want to settle cases. Well, there's no lack of work, believe me. Like, this is, it's not like you want to draw out a case because you don't have another client waiting. Like, it's, if you're good at practicing family law, you're very busy. Just, that's just the way it is. And it's not an area of law you get rich from, so people don't go into it to make money. That would be like ridiculous. Like, that would be, I mean, compared, when you get out of law school, if you're thinking, like, what kind of lawyer do I want to be? Oh, I want to make a lot of money. I want to be a divorce lawyer. Like, it's not an area where you make a lot of money. So, you know, compared to other areas of practice. So, I do think that people transfer onto lawyers, you know, this pain of their divorce sometimes gets misapplied to the lawyers who really were not doing anything bad. However, there are some lawyers like you're talking about, and I would say once in a while I have a case with a lawyer like that, and I feel like there's less like that than when I started practicing, because I think the practice of family law has changed somewhat, but there are some who just want to litigate, who don't support their clients in trying to reach their own agreements. you know, and think everything had to go through the lawyers, and they start out every case with, you know, serving interrogatories and piles of, you know, discovery, and make it into this big piece of litigation, which nobody wants it to be. Like, no one comes and sits in your office and says, I want to spend as much money as possible and I want to go to court. And nobody has ever said that to me, or I can guarantee any other lawyer. Like, that's not what people want. And so it's very difficult when someone has a lawyer like that. But you know what? They're responsible for that. If they don't like what the lawyer's doing, you fire the lawyer and you change
Right, but here's the problem.
People do it all the time.
Margaret, but here's the problem, because it's not been my experience. And in practice in 37 years in New York City, doing both mediation and doing executive life coaching, I find that the lawyers, many of the lawyers, not all, again, there's lots of good lawyers and lots of my friends are lawyers, but what they do is they actually sympathize with the person's emotions, and divorce is highly emotional. And if you could, in fact, you know, there's so much emotion, there's so little rationality when you're in the midst of the divorce. And if you could identify with the person's emotions, then at one point you hear people say, I don't care what I have to spend. I just want A, B, and C. When in fact, so many people getting divorced, in my experience, number one, say, if I knew what I had to go through, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, and I think that is a problem. And there are some lawyers who, and I tried to really write about that in the book. There's a chapter called Opposing Counsel, which is about the relationships between opposing counsel and about how there are some lawyers who, like, take on their clients' causes with this personal kind of a fervor. And that's bad lawyering. I mean, it's not effective. It's expensive for the client, and it's not appropriate. It's you need to empathize with people, but you need to be the counselor. You're you're an attorney, which means advocate, and counselor at law. That's what lawyers are. You're supposed to advise people. So your job is to say, okay, well, here's what it's going to cost to file that motion over, you know, a $500 item. You're going to spend $1,500. That's just not a good use of your money. And I don't, you know, that's, it's your job to say that to your client and to try to calm things down, because you're not their friend. You're not a cheerleader for their position. You are there to give them professional advice in an area that they're not a professional in. So I just, you know, I don't have a lot of respect for lawyers that get all hopped up about their clients. Like, you need to care and be a passionate advocate when you go into court. That's your job, you know. But when you're dealing with opposing counsel, or, you know, you just need to keep it calm. And I think that it does a service to the client. Not, you know, it's not, they're really not wanting to pay you, you know, hundreds of dollars an hour to be their cheerleader.
Then tell us the story about Beth and Brian, because it did seem to me that you got involved there.
Sure. I mean, I get involved. I don't mean to say, like, I don't care, or that we don't.
I didn't mean that.
You have to care. You wouldn't do this kind of work. But So the story that you're referring to is in the book, I take a custody trial from, like, start to finish. And that's the one part of my book that's actually a composite of, like, different cases. It's fictionalized in a sense, but it's actually really accurate, because I took several custody cases, trials that I've had, and tried to sort of distill the issues that I think are come up frequently. And those issues are, you have a parent who has been abusive in the past when the parties live together, and you have a young child, who tells the mom that something happened to them, that the father did something to them, but the child won't tell anybody else that. And so you have to try to, and the father denies it and says that the mother is just trying to retaliate against him for divorcing her, for or she's mad at him for some other reason. What, he had an affair, but she's lying. She's lying to, which is a horrible thing to do, to try to keep him from having time with his children. And she's, you know, this is a dynamic that, like, comes up all the time. And so that case is about trying a custody case where I'm trying to prove that there was abuse against the child committed by the father, but I have a child who won't tell anybody else that, including when he's interviewed by the judge, won't speak to the judge. And the mother's testimony that the child told me this is not generally admissible in court. It's hearsay. And it's a very complex issue, and I was trying to just explore all sides of it in the book.
You don't want to weigh in on the Woody Allen Mia Farrow issue.
Weigh in on it.
You know what? All I can weigh in on is I can't believe that this incredibly personal, horrible family conflict is getting played out in the pages of the New York Times. Like, that's my reaction to it.
You know what? That's a great reaction, and I happen to agree. I want to go back to your title, Keeping It Civil. Okay. Now, how much of Keeping It Civil is up to the clients, and how much of is it up to the lawyers? And where and does mediation come in between two lawyers and a mediator who kind of calms things down? How do you keep it civil?
Well, I think the lawyers do play a big part in that, and that's, you know, what we were just talking about before. The lawyers, their job should be to try to ratchet down the emotion and try to help the clients get through the process. So I think that is a big part of it. But I also think that there is really a shift that I have seen in the culture of divorce, and that especially my younger clients who are getting divorced really don't want the kind of knockdown, drag-out fights that maybe their parents got divorced and they saw, you know, the War of the Roses type divorces. They really reject that, and they're much more interested in a more do-it-yourself approach, and certainly mediation is a big part of that, and we always encourage that unless it's a case where, like, there's domestic violence or there's some reason that it doesn't make sense for people to be in a room together. But mediation or collaborative divorce, which is, I'm sure you know about that, that's a new sort of model of divorce that involves lawyers but not going to court. But I think that part of that shift is also connected to the rise of joint custody as, like, a norm for people. And they're connected because I feel that a number of my clients are very aware that they need to really preserve a decent relationship with the other parent because they're going to be dealing with them all the time. You know, and so you can't just walk away and burn your bridges, because it's different if the other parent is just going to be seeing the kids, you know, every other weekend over Saturday night. You don't really care what your relationship is like with them. But if you're dealing with them day in, day out about school issues and medical issues, and, you know, you're really co-parenting, which is much more the norm than it was 20 years ago, I think you have a very vested interest in trying to kind of reconfigure your family in a civil way, as civil as possible, and not, you know, the term broken family is kind of out of the lexicon. Nobody uses that anymore. So I think it's a much better model, and I do think it's generational. Like, I really noticed a difference in the expectations of my younger clients about divorce from some of my older clients.
I was just going to say, love, though, is such a cataclysmic emotion. I mean, it is so powerful. I mean, what happens when there's asymmetry, when the man has left the woman for a younger model and she is filled with rage? I mean, that's inescapable, isn't it? I mean, no matter what generation you're talking about, they have joint custody, and yes, they try to be reasonable. They try to work out some peaceful coupledom apart. And an irrational arrangement. But reason and love, quote Cornelia, are sworn enemies, and they're very, very hard, I would think, to...
No, I agree with you, and I would say the cases where I see the most anger and rage are not cases where people have young children to deal with, because they're just preoccupied with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It is the woman who's in her late 50s, early 60s, you know, 30 or 40 year marriage, who's dumped for the younger wife, who is, her whole life is just like shattered by that, and she's furious.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, my job in representing someone like that is not to fuel the rage, to acknowledge it, of course, but to really try to get the last, as much money as I can as possible for that client, because I'm thinking specifically of the woman that isn't self-supporting. It's usually in that scenario that this comes up. You know, the rest of her financial life is completely dependent on the divorce settlement. And so she's not only enraged, she's terrified.
Mm-hmm.
And really all I can do for her is just really be careful about making sure we do the best job we can to get her the most money possible, because that's all you can get in that situation. You know, that's the only thing I can do for her. Not for revenge or for not whatever. It's just, she's dependent. She is financially dependent, and that's, you know.
It makes perfect sense, Margaret. And in fact, what you're doing is you're balancing out the equality of life, because here is this man who feels that he could at any point simply exchange his wife for a younger version, and not have to pay the price for that, and to leave his wife devastated. It just simply is wrong.
Well, one thing I can tell you about those cases, though, that, and forgive me if this is obvious, but it's something that's not obvious to my clients all the time, is if I'm dealing with someone who has been, you know, dumped, like does not want the divorce, and is dumped for another woman, or, you know, and by the way, it's not all in that gender configuration, but my client's inclination generally is, I don't want this divorce. I'm not doing anything to cooperate with it. He has to file. I'm going to wait it out, because in our state, you can't get divorced right away if the other person doesn't consent. I'm going to make him wait. I really try to counsel those people that we're probably going to do better in a settlement to cooperate, because your spouse feels guilty. And 2 years from now, he may not feel so guilty. He's separated himself from you. So don't do anything to make yourself the bad guy. Be the victim, and let's try to get you as much money as possible. Like, I mean, that's just human nature.
It also sounds like good counsel. How about prenups? Yeah. How about what do you think about prenups these days? They are much more common. Do they help preserve a marriage, or are they the beginning of the foundation of the cracks in a marriage?
You know, I don't know if they have any effect on a marriage. I think there's really two kinds of prenups in my mind, and they're really in different scenarios. You know, one is like typically like the older wealthy guy marrying the young woman with nothing who wants to make sure that she's not just after him for his money. You know, that's kind of a scenario we're all familiar with. But the other that I actually see now is more common is where you have it's like a second marriage and both people have children, and it's more, they're on parity with each other. They both want to preserve what they have for their children. And those prenups seem to me like the most sensible document in the world. Like, I get, you know, they both have common interests. The first scenario, there's no commonality of interest. Like, the lawyer's job meeting with that young woman who's about to marry the wealthy guy who wants her to waive all these claims is to say, don't sign it. Like, there's no benefit to you to signing this. And then she signs it anyway. You write a letter telling her that's what your vice is. And then she signs it because she wants to get married, you know, and hopefully they won't get divorced and she'll have a lovely lifestyle in the marriage. But it's not, there's no benefit to her. That those people's interests are really, you know, in conflict. But I do see a lot of second marriages where people are doing prenups. It's more, maybe I just said this, but it's more like estate planning, really. They're planning for either divorce or death. They want to make sure that their property that they accumulated, you know, in the first half of their lives is going to go to their children, not the spouse.
Yeah, there's potential for inequality there too, though, right? I mean, because one person may be wealthier than the other and want to give the majority of his or her estate to the children and shortchange the new wife and her children. I mean, I'm sure it's very complex.
Well, every scenario is different for sure. But yeah. I think that, I guess what I'm pointing out about that scenario is that usually my experience with those prenups is both people are in agreement that this is a good idea. Mm-hmm. They both want them. Whereas in the other scenario, the young bride doesn't want the prenup. She's making a she's saying, well, I want to get married more than I, you know, outweighs my, I've been told I shouldn't sign this, but I'm going to do it anyway because I want to get married, but it's against her interest to sign it.
Yeah, there was a New York Times article that the divorce is much more likely in a case like that.
Margaret, tell me about your experience in terms of how money should be handled in marriage. Which scenario works the best? People keeping their finances separately and then having a joint account, or everything in one pot? Where are there the least amount of conflicts?
You know, I've thought about that question a lot because people, I don't have any way of knowing, like, what most people do versus the people I see who are getting divorced. I am always surprised by how many people I work with as divorce clients who have kept all their money separate during the marriage. That seems like an odd model to me. Just, I guess it wasn't the way I was raised, and it's not the way I do it in my own marriage. So I've always been surprised by that. Like, well, I pay the gas bill and she pays the cable bill, or, you know, like it. So I don't, you know, it could be that people that have that kind of setup are more likely to get divorced because they think of everything as like mine and yours. But I don't know that. Maybe the percentage of people who do that are getting divorced is the same as the percentage in the happily married population. So it's hard for me to know. I certainly, you know, I would say most people pool their money. Most people do pool their money and maybe keep a separate account for some particular reason, you know. But there are people that do it completely separately. And, you know, there are some advantages if you're getting divorced to having separated accounts in specific scenarios, like, you know, you get an inheritance and you keep it in your separate name. In most states, I think every state, but I don't know for sure, but most states certainly, it doesn't become marital property, whereas if you put it into a joint account, you've, like, given it to the marriage. So there's certain things you could exempt from a claim by the other spouse by keeping them in separate names, but I think that it's one of those things that is just, you know, different in every family, and like it's hard to say that one causes or makes you more likely to have the marriage end. But here's the one thing I would say that I know is bad if you're getting divorced is the model where one person takes care of all of the finances and the other spouse doesn't know anything about them. That is not a good scenario when you're getting divorced because the spouse who doesn't know anything about the finances feels like at a real disadvantage and they have a lot of catching up to do. And they, you know, it's just like you should read a tax return before you sign it or at least look at it, you know. I'm always amazed when people come in and they have no idea what their spouse earns. Like, I find that incredible.
That really
you know?
Is incredible. Yeah. Margaret, now you're married. You've never been divorced, correct?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever been divorced?
I have not been divorced.
Okay, excellent. Have any of your friends been divorced?
Yes.
Now, do they come to you and ask you for advice, and will you take on any of your friends?
I have developed a policy about that, as you can imagine. Here's my policy. If I have their friends where I'm friends with both members of the couple, not only do I not take it on, I don't want my firm involved. If it's a friend where I don't really have a relationship with the other spouse, but I do, you know them, an acquaintance, I'll suggest to the friend, why don't you work with one of my partners, but not me? So that's what I do. I don't take on divorces that involve my friends. I just, like, it seems like a real, really bad idea to me. And people seem to really understand that.
What do you do when you see people in their 70s and 80s looking to get divorced?
Well, I don't see too many of them, but I do see them sometimes. You know, it really depends on the reasons. I mean, there are some people who get divorced for, like, financial planning reasons, who are happily married, and that, you know, for, like,
tax purposes,
Medicare issues, and yeah, there. I mean, that does happen sometimes. But I just, you know, want to make sure that it benefits them to get divorced, because, you know, if they stay married, especially if the other spouse, like if you have like a 70-year-old and the other spouse is 85, like, why don't you just wait it out? You know?
Just wait it out. I like that idea.
So let me ask you. It doesn't come up that often. That is an unusual case when you get to that age. I think most people don't think it's worth it to get divorced at that point. If they're unhappy, they're just, you know, whatever.
Oh. Betsy, to your statistic that there are, when you read earlier, that there are 3 women getting shot and 1 man getting shot every day?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to tell you that women need more practice with guns. So
they said killed. They didn't go into weapon. But
okay,
you can
well,
just imagine.
They just need a little bit more practice. This way it evens things out.
No, I think that the more interesting statistic is that between 2000 and 2006, 3,200 men were killed in the military, but 10,600 were killed in domestic violence. So that's an issue that is very thorny and is not working right now. I know you read the New Yorker article last year on the subject about how that entire system is broken, and we don't know how to fix it right now. But I wanted to ask you about the future. There are these issues that are going to crop up. I mean, like, who owns fertilized eggs, for example? I mean, and transgender issues and same-sex partnerships. I mean, how do you envision the future of family law?
Well, one of the things that I love about family law, and another reason I wrote the book, is because it's such a fast-changing area of the law, because the definition of family is changing so fast in our society, and the law is struggling to keep up with that in some instances, and in others, the law is actually like pushing the culture, is out ahead of the culture, you know. So, like with the same-sex marriage debate, when the first court in the country that ruled that it was unconstitutional under their state constitution to prohibit same-sex couples from getting married was Massachusetts, and that was 10 years ago. That was in 2004, and that was radical. I mean, do you remember that? That was like a big, like, there was all this hue and cry about, you know, activist judges and how can they do this, and it was way ahead of popular opinion about gay marriage. And now, you know, in the decade, it's completely flipped in terms of public opinion. Like in my state, which we do not have same-sex marriage, we have a statute that prohibits it, which is being heavily challenged right now. But the polling shows that public opinion now in Pennsylvania, which is not a liberal state, actually is favors, you know, a majority of people in Pennsylvania favor the right of same-sex couples to marry. So, like, that's a huge change. So now, you know, the courts, we're looking to the courts to try to catch up with that public opinion in a lot of states. And in 2004, the court made a decision that, you know, was kind of pushed the society. And I think that is very interesting. And the whole reproductive technology field is like that too, like who owns fertilized eggs. I mean, that's come up in a number of states. And, you know, all of this is a matter of state law, so it's always going to be different. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people have frozen embryos and they get divorced. And, you know, can the mom keep them and force the ex-husband to become a father after divorce? Like, these are really challenging questions, and there's no one answer to them. And there's a lot of activity in the courts on family law, and it's dizzying.
Do you ever see America moving toward the French model, the PAC Are you familiar with the PAC model in France?
No, I'm not.
Oh, it's interesting. Well, you can live together with all the benefits of marriage, but without any legal intervention whatsoever, just a piece of paper, you walk to City Hall and you dissolve the union.
There's a number of countries that have different gradations like that of marriage or domestic partnership that have less obligation, like gradations of rights and obligations. And I have represented people from other countries that was the case in their country. And I don't really see us going to that model because there seems to be such a strong push in this country to marriage. I mean, the LGBT community has been really hyped on marriage equality as a cornerstone of equality, as opposed to expand civil unions for everybody. That's not been, the hue and cry. And I think, in this country, people really want to be married. I mean,
why?
People that get divorced, so many of my clients, they remarry. Mm-hmm. Like, they get divorced, but they remarry. I feel like it's, and I don't know because I've never lived in another country, but I feel like this country is very marriage focused.
We are, because I think that marriage represents a form of stability, a form of safety, a form of closure that I'm not out there, and as false as it may be in terms of the difference between being married or just fully committed, it's still within the American psyche.
Yes.
Question, Margaret. Who can't afford to be divorced? Who would you say, listen, guys, you're both going to be living in poverty? Question one. And two, how does alimony, for our listeners, how does alimony and child support actually work?
Okay, well, the first question about who can't afford to be divorced is, there's a lot of people who are barely getting by living in one household. Let's say there's only one income, or there's two low incomes, and maybe their house is underwater with their mortgage. And those are people that it's going to be really tough to, you can sell your house and get nothing from it, okay, and then you have, maybe you just have debt and no savings at all. So for those people, it financially makes more sense to live under one roof, but I don't really think that may be a reason that people delay divorce. And I definitely saw that during the real estate bust where, people's houses dropped in value significantly and they felt stuck in these houses. Especially younger families, often the equity in a house is the only thing they do have that's potentially liquid. They have retirement accounts, but they don't have any savings. So, I think people end up staying together in a house, kind of living as roommates, living separate in a household, in the same house, for longer than they would in a more, in a better economy. But I'm not sure it's a reason people don't get divorced, because I think that, as you were saying before, that's an emotional decision more than a financial decision. It's really not in anybody's financial interest to get divorced, because you can always live together more cheaply than you can live apart. I don't think there's any exception to that, really, because two households, are more expensive than one. So alimony and child support, how does it work? Well, child support's an entitlement that children have under federal law. Every state has to have a set of child support guidelines, and every parent has an obligation to support their children. And that is a universal, meaning federal.
So it's not
law.
Federal guidelines, it's state guidelines.
It's state guidelines, but the federal law requires every state to have them. So the federal law gives the states the right to figure out a formula, but the federal law requires guidelines. And the federal government gets involved in enforcing child support. So there's a whole network that's set up so that when a person who's paying it moves from one state to another, they can still have their wages attached. When that person owes child support and files a tax return and is entitled to a refund, their refund gets intercepted by the federal government and then paid to the state where the child support order is to release to the person who's supposed to get the child support. So there is a federal mechanism in place to try to enforce child support. And I think child support enforcement has really improved since I've been practicing family law. I mean, there's still a lot of people who don't pay their child support. People that are self-employed are really hard. You know, it's much harder to get support from them than somebody that works for wages, because their wages can be attached.
What is the percentage, though? It's pretty high of deadbeat dads. Or that's an old-fashioned expression, because it could be deadbeat moms
parent.
Now. Deadbeat parent.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, and I'm sure it's, you know, it varies by state and probably by county with how aggressive courts are about enforcing child support orders, and states are about enforcing them. So I don't know, but it's certainly easier now. I mean, just anecdotally from my perspective, if I have a parent who owes a non-custodial parent who's going to owe child support, who works for somebody else, you know, a W-2 wage earner, there's just no issue about enforcing child support, because you get an order, you get it quickly, the person's wages are attached, and they don't have any. It's just like a tax, you know, withholding from your paycheck.
Is the same true for alimony?
Excuse me?
Is the same true for alimony?
Well, so alimony is a completely different animal than child support, and alimony is a post-divorce economic remedy that's available more or less in different states and under different circumstances. It's not an entitlement for everybody according to a formula at all. Alimony can't, like in my state, yes, alimony could be paid through a wage attachment, but it's not an automatic thing. And there are, in general, I would say, so, you know, some states, it's hard to talk about this universally because every state is different, but in general, alimony, there are factors for whether or not alimony is part of a divorce resolution, and if so, how much. There's a bunch of factors that are considered by a court and therefore by divorce lawyers in trying to negotiate it. There are some states that have a formula for alimony, like, you know, for the duration of it and for the amount of it. But a lot of states are like my state, Pennsylvania, which has just factors. And, you know, generally, if there's enough assets to be divided and you can shift more assets to the dependent spouse, then that's it. Then we would prefer to do that than have alimony being paid, because you get everything now. You don't have to worry about enforcing it or modifying it or anything like that. I mean, it's preferable to sort of do a clean break, but sometimes you don't have any. Maybe all you have is a house and a pension and a high income on one side and a low income on the other, or no income on the other, and that's the case where the only thing you can do to kind of put the parties on, create any kind of economic parity post-divorce, is to use the device of alimony. But I consider it like a secondary remedy. I'd rather get cash. I'd rather have the money now for my client to manage and not have to be getting a check every month, you know. And I think that's a lot of, you know, I think that's sensible, and most people who work in family law feel that way too.
You say that women are not considered the weaker party anymore in the law, but is that really your experience?
Well, no, it's not my experience in terms of financial control. Like, I think a lot of what we were talking about before, about the woman who's never, you know, who hasn't worked outside the home and is married for a long time and doesn't, you know, she's definitely weaker in the sense that she's financially dependent and may also lack any financial knowledge. So she's sort of emotionally at a disadvantage as well. But the divorce code, the provisions of our divorce laws, take that into account. Like that, I mean, that's the big change in modern divorce law, is not only the no-fault grounds for divorce, but also recognizing the non-economic contributions of a homemaker. You know, the fact that she didn't earn one penny during the marriage and everything was earned in the husband's name. Let's say he kept all the money separate and his pension. That's all, in every state, marital property that gets shared with her. And that was a revolution, you know, and that, in the 19th century, you know, you got divorced, you were out in the street if you didn't have anything in your name. So that's the way in which the laws are, I think, gender neutral, and it goes the other way too. And a lot of my women breadwinner clients are very upset about that they have to share their retirement accounts and savings accounts yeah. with their husbands who didn't work.
Yeah, the slackers you talk about.
The slackers, right. And I have to say, I don't have a lot of male clients who consider their wives who stayed home slackers, but I have a lot of female clients who do. And, you know, maybe it's because the female clients also did all the... Maybe they did all the housework and did all the child care. Or maybe it's just a cultural expectation. But yeah. I do find it's harder for them to have to share when they get divorced.
It's a fascinating period of transition we're in.
Yes, it is a period. It really is.
When you find the 70-plus-year-old man marrying yeah. the 35-plus young, attractive arm candy without a prenup, yeah. is there always a divorce down the road, or is she just going to wait till he dies?
You know, I don't know, because I don't know those people unless they're in my office, in which case they're getting divorced. So I don't know. But, I mean, it seems like she might just wait.
There's actually a funny joke about that. An 85-year-old guy has this piece of arm candy with him, and his friends are all clustered around saying, "How in the world did you get her?" And he said, "Oh, I lied. I said I was 95.
That's funny. You know, there is, when we're talking about prenups in this situation, or not necessarily the older guy, but the guy with money marrying the younger woman usually, one of the things that is common in those prenups is what's called a sunset clause, where after a certain number of years of marriage, the prenup goes away.
And how many years normally is that?
Well, it depends on the contract, but a lot of times it goes like this. You know, if we get divorced after 5 years of marriage, she gets, you know, X dollars. But after, you know, for every year after that, she gets X more dollars. And if it's after 15 years of marriage, this agreement is null and void. Like, it's to avoid the, like, gold digger, you know, the concern that the marriage is just for money. And so that actually, I always feel better if that's in the prenup, you know, because that seems to me like I get the reason that the person might want to have that, as opposed to if she's never going to get anything no matter when we get divorced.
Margaret, what happens to the people who meet at 18 and they stay together literally 30 years, raise a family, never got married, act as a married couple, were in love as a married couple, and then seek to break up? Is there any protection for either one of them?
They're a long marriage, people that met young and then...
And never got married. They just
Got married. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, it really depends on the state. But because this is a matter of... There are some states that have a provision for some kind of claim, even though there wasn't a marriage. And there are also some states that have common law marriage, and they might meet the definition of common law marriage,
yeah,
although that's really disappearing.
Right, that's in my native South. We have common law marriages.
Well, and every state, I'm pretty sure, used to have common law marriage, but most states have abolished it mm-hmm. because it causes so much confusion about what it is, and people relied on it and were wrong and thought they were common law married, and then it turns out they didn't meet the definition. So a lot of states have abolished it, but there are some states that you could make a claim for. I mean, remember Palimony, that, you know, the case Lee Marvin, and so, you know, that whole concept of there's a duty of support owed because the person relied on the idea that they were going to be supported even though they're never married. There's some states that, you know, honor those claims, and then there are other states that don't. I don't know of any state that would permit the division of property, or that would order the division of property that's not titled in joint names. You know, in other words, people are not married. The house is in the male partner's name. Like, award a piece of the house to the wife in the absence of the divorce laws that permit that. Like, I don't think that claim works. And certainly claims on, like, pensions don't, because you're not a spouse under federal law, and that pensions are controlled by ERISA, federal law. So I think the support claim is pretty much all you have. But, you know, if you title things in joint names, then they get split 50-50, just like if you and I had a bank account together, it would be half yours and half mine. So that is a little different than if you're married, because in a divorce, things don't necessarily get divided 50-50, but at least that's certainly much better than if everything's in one person's name. And I have had those cases where someone lived together for 20 years, and, you know, I've been in the position of having to give them the bad news that you know, all those properties that your boyfriend, your partner bought, you know, in his name, like...
They belong to him, yeah.
They belong to him, yeah.
So my last question, because we could go on forever, and you have been an amazing interviewer, or interviewee, is this. Why are there so many jokes about divorce lawyers? What's the story with that?
I don't know. But I'll tell you that all of these people who have, like, reviewed my book on Amazon and stuff, like, I'm not talking about my friends and relatives, like people that I don't know, they all say, wow, I didn't realize that divorce lawyers could be such, like, thoughtful people. So I'm on a one-woman campaign to improve our image.
Well, you are wearing the white hat, and we're going to applaud that.
Yes, and wave the flag for you.
Yeah, we'll back you up. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. You're
Me
a wonderful
too.
Guest.
You're great.
Oh, great.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
I want to once again thank Margaret Clore for appearing on GluckRadio.com. Be sure to actually pick up a copy of her book, Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche, and other true accounts from the files of a family lawyer. Visit her website at margaretclaw.com. That's K-L-A-W with a K. Betsy, this woman clearly wears a white hat. I do think that she is so naive about the intentions of lawyers and, in fact, in their motives. I find it really interesting how that almost 99 out of 100 people will tell you that, A, when they call a lawyer, they don't call back, and, B, when they have a five-minute conversation, they're billed for an hour. So she must, in my mind, she really seemed really sincere, but I think that the alternatives to divorce, which is mediation, where everyone's in the same room, I think should really be considered.
I agree. And she admits it, actually, right in the middle of the book. She says the judges are subjective. People lie under oath. It takes years for a case to get through court. There's racism involved. She goes into all of those things and then still comes out Little Mary Sunshine. And I agree with her. I mean, I love that optimism, and says, I still believe in the justice system, in the law right now. But I agree with you. She doesn't acknowledge all of those people out there who are bilking the system.
I guess the true believers are actually holding up society by a thread. But thank God for them, because cynics don't tend to build a lot of things.
Yeah, you're right. Thank God we have these pioneers. I thought she was very articulate, and thank God she's on the barricades.
Yeah, she was actually wonderful. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Betsy and I both want you to remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Please check out our other episodes on www.gluckradio.com. You should be tweeting this to all your friends, Facebooking them. There is something for everyone. Buy Betsy Prelow's book on the art of seduction on Amazon.com. They're entitled Swoon and Seductress.
And go to Huffington Post under Books Today and read my article, Can Seducers Save Valentine's Day? It's controversial. I'm dying to hear your thoughts, so please weigh in.
Keep listening. Keep sending us your feedback. We have so many episodes, and we are beginning to take sponsors. So if you want to sponsor a show that everyone knows that this is something you want to identify with, you give us a call and we will actually hook you up. We are growing, we are being listened to, and so should you. Till next time.